I want to start with a number. After 20 hours awake, which is completely ordinary, a late night out or a long travel day, your cognitive impairment is equivalent to a blood alcohol level of 0.1%. Legally drunk in most countries.
Welcome to Claude Talks. I'm Ryan.
And I'm Emma. And today we're going deep on sleep. Not put your phone down before bed deep. Actually deep. The kind that made me rethink my entire relationship with sleep, and honestly with my partner.
We'll get to the relationship angle. That's the centerpiece of today's episode, because it's the most underrated sleep topic in the whole conversation. But first, the scale of the problem.
Matthew Walker, neuroscientist, author of Why We Sleep, has this line I find genuinely haunting. No aspect of our biology is left unscathed by sleep deprivation. That's an extraordinary claim.
And the evidence backs it up. One bad night. Just one. You lose 70% of your natural killer cells, the immune cells that hunt down infected and cancerous cells.
70%. After a single bad night.
That sounds like something you'd make up for effect. But it's a real finding.
And on top of that, cortisol spikes, insulin sensitivity drops, and your prefrontal cortex, the part handling rational decision-making and emotional regulation, goes offline first when you're sleep-deprived.
Which explains why sleep-deprived people are worse at almost everything and are also the worst judges of their own impairment.
That's the really insidious part. If you're drunk, you have some awareness of it. With sleep deprivation, especially chronic sleep deprivation, your perception of how you're functioning completely decouples from your actual functioning.
Studies have shown that after 10 days of sleeping 6 hours a night, performance degrades as badly as after total sleep deprivation. But people stop feeling tired. They lose the ability to notice it.
They think they're fine.
They will confidently tell you they're fine. And they are measurably, demonstrably wrong.
There's a concept called the neurobehavioral performance gap. You start to lose the ability to accurately benchmark yourself. The impaired version of you is the one assessing whether you're impaired.
It's like asking a drunk person how drunk they are. They'll say, "I'm fine." Because the very faculties you'd use to make that assessment are the ones compromised.
And then there's microsleep. While driving or doing anything, your brain can check out for 2 to 3 seconds. You have no awareness of it. You can't detect it. Your eyes may even stay open.
And in that 2-second blackout, you've driven at 100 kilometers an hour. 50 meters. Nobody at the wheel.
Drowsy driving kills more people than drunk driving in some estimates. And the World Health Organization has classified shift work, disrupted circadian rhythms, chronic sleep disruption, as a probable carcinogen.
Not because of the work itself. Because of what the circadian disruption does to the body over years.
The mechanism is partly that chronic circadian disruption affects DNA repair, immune surveillance, and hormonal regulation, all the systems that would normally catch and correct abnormal cells.
Exactly. And it's not just cancer. The cardiovascular risk profile, the metabolic risk profile, the mental health risk profile, all of them are significantly elevated by chronic short sleep. Every major organ system is affected.
So sleep is not optional, not laziness, not something you power through with coffee. It is the foundation. And now that we've established the horror, let's understand what's actually happening when we sleep.
Because most people think sleep is unconsciousness. Passive downtime. It isn't. It's the most active biological process your body runs.
So there are two main types of sleep, NREM and REM. Non-rapid eye movement and rapid eye movement. NREM has 3 stages.
Stage 1 and 2 are relatively light. Stage 1 is the transition, the drifting feeling, sometimes the hypnic jerk as you drop off. Stage 2 is where you see sleep spindles on an EEG, bursts of neural activity at 12 to 15 cycles per second, associated with memory consolidation.
And K-complexes, the brain's noise suppression mechanism, a way of staying asleep through minor disturbances in the environment.
Then stage 3. Slow wave sleep. Deep sleep. Characterized by delta waves, large, slow oscillations. This is where the biological heavy lifting happens.
Growth hormone is released almost exclusively here. physical repair, immune function, and declarative memory consolidation, facts and events. It's also the hardest stage to wake someone from. Try waking someone from deep sleep and they'll be groggy and disoriented for minutes.
And critically, deep sleep is concentrated in the first half of the night. If you go to bed at midnight instead of 10, you're not just losing 2 hours. You're losing deep sleep from those early cycles.
Then REM, rapid eye movement, the dream state. The brain is almost as active as when you're awake, but the body is essentially paralyzed, the brain's way of preventing you from acting out your dreams.
Walker calls REM overnight therapy. You're replaying emotional memories in a neurochemical environment stripped of noradrenaline, the main stress hormone. So you can process difficult experiences without the raw pain of reliving them.
REM is also where creative insight happens. The connections between disparate ideas that you couldn't make while awake, and procedural memory, motor skills, spatial navigation.
And REM is concentrated in the second half of the night. The last few cycles of an 8-hour sleep are overwhelmingly REM-rich.
So if you sleep 6 hours instead of 8, you haven't lost 25% of your sleep. You've lost almost all of your REM. Those last 2 hours are disproportionately the dreaming, emotional processing, creative insight hours.
The math is brutal and it's not intuitive. You think you lost 25%. You actually lost something closer to 60 or 70% of your REM.
Each night runs 4 to 5 90-minute cycles. Early cycles, mostly deep sleep. Late cycles, mostly REM. Cut the night short and you're selectively removing the most psychologically important phase.
And most people are cutting it short on the morning end, an alarm at 6 a.m. slices off the last 1 or 2 cycles. Those REM-rich cycles.
Consistently cutting REM is essentially doing what some antidepressants do as a side effect. Many antidepressants suppress REM, and we know that REM suppression is associated with worsened emotional regulation, reduced creativity, impaired procedural learning.
Which raises an interesting question about whether some of the mood effects from chronic short sleep are partly REM deprivation effects rather than just fatigue. Two chemical systems drive all of this, adenosine and the circadian clock. Adenosine first.
Adenosine is a byproduct of brain activity. From the moment you wake up, it accumulates. It's the chemical signal of sleep pressure. The longer you're awake, the more has built up, the sleepier you feel. When you sleep, it's cleared.
Caffeine works by blocking adenosine receptors. It doesn't clear adenosine, it just prevents you feeling it. The adenosine is still there, building up behind the blockade.
When caffeine wears off, half-life of 5 to 7 hours, the adenosine floods the receptors. That's the crash. Not caffeine leaving. The debt coming due.
The circadian clock is the other system. A roughly 24.2-hour internal clock, driven by the suprachiasmatic nucleus in the hypothalamus, about 20,000 neurons acting as a master timekeeper. The primary reset signal is light.
Morning sunlight hits the retina, signals the SCN, cascades through the whole body. Cortisol rises, core temperature starts climbing, you become alert. This is the anchor. Miss it. Stay indoors, blinds down, and the clock drifts.
Melatonin is the complementary signal. As evening comes and light dims, the pineal gland releases melatonin. But melatonin is not a sleeping pill, it's a timing signal. It tells your body it's dark, prepare for sleep. The actual sleep mechanisms are separate.
This is why taking 5 milligrams of melatonin doesn't necessarily make you sleep better. It just shifts the timing signal.
And core body temperature. Your body needs to drop its core temperature by 1 to 3 degrees Celsius to initiate sleep. It does this by vasodilating the hands and feet, literally dumping heat through your extremities.
This is why a warm bath before bed helps you fall asleep faster. The bath draws blood to the surface, you step out into cool air, heat radiates away rapidly, core temperature drops quickly. The brain gets the signal it needs.
Warm bath, cool core, sleep. Counterintuitive but elegant.
Okay, evidence-based interventions. The ones that actually have research behind them.
Huberman's number one recommendation, and I completely agree with it, morning light. Outside within 60 minutes of waking. 10 to 20 minutes of natural light, even on a cloudy day.
Even overcast, outdoor light is 10 to 50 times brighter than indoor lighting. Your photoreceptors need that intensity to lock the circadian anchor.
No sunglasses for the first 10 to 15 minutes. Light needs to hit the retina directly. This is free, it takes 10 minutes, and it's probably the single highest return sleep habit that exists.
The flip side, no bright light at night. Blue spectrum light from phones and screens suppresses melatonin by up to 50%. F.Lux Night Mode Blue Light Glasses, these all help. But the best intervention is simply dimming all lights and switching to warm amber bulbs in the evening.
Bedroom temperature. 18 to 19 degrees Celsius is the sweet spot. The room should feel slightly cool. For hot sleepers, mattress cooling pads like 8 Sleep or Chillipad circulate temperature-controlled water through the mattress. Each side can often be set independently.
Consistency. Same wake time 7 days a week. Not the same bedtime, the same wake time. The bedtime can flex. The wake time should be fixed.
Each 1 hour drift in sleep timing measurably impairs next day cognition. What researchers call social jet lag, different sleep timing on weekdays versus weekends, is associated with obesity, metabolic dysfunction, worse mental health outcomes.
The morning after a weekend lie-in, you've essentially given yourself mild jet lag, and you're spending Monday recovering from Sunday.
Caffeine. The half-life is 5 to 7 hours. The quarter-life, time for it to drop to a quarter of the dose, is 10 to 12 hours. A coffee at 2 p.m., a quarter of that caffeine is still in your system at midnight. Still blocking adenosine receptors. Still measurably reducing deep sleep.
The people who say they can drink coffee at 6 p.m. and sleep fine, yes, they can fall asleep. But their sleep architecture is compromised. Less deep sleep. And they don't perceive the difference, which is precisely the problem.
Alcohol is the same category of misunderstanding. It sedates you. But sedation and natural sleep are completely different neurological states. Alcohol fragments sleep, more awakenings, suppressed REM, rebound wakefulness in the back half of the night. Even one or two drinks measurably affects quality.
Exercise is excellent for sleep, but timing matters. Vigorous exercise within 2 to 4 hours of bed raises core temperature and cortisol, delaying sleep onset. Morning or early afternoon is optimal. A light evening walk fine. An intense run at 9 p.m. not ideal.
Naps. A 10 to 20 minute nap, the NASA nap, improves performance without sleep inertia. Keep it under 20 minutes to avoid entering deep sleep and waking groggy. A 90 minute nap captures a full cycle and is restorative. Don't nap after 3 p.m., you'll deplete adenosine pressure and delay your night sleep.
Now, I want to push back on some of this, because there's a real danger in how sleep advice is packaged, a direction the conversation has gone that's actually counterproductive.
Challenge me.
The 8 hours for everyone claim. Walker has done incredible things for public understanding, but the idea that everyone needs exactly 8 hours is contested. There are genuine short sleepers, people with a December 2nd gene mutation, roughly 3% of the population, who function optimally on 6 to 6.5 hours.
3% is a tiny number.
Very tiny. And the more common situation is people who believe they're in that 3% but aren't. They've adapted to the feeling of chronic impairment. But the point stands, the evidence for exactly 8 hours for all humans is less solid than it's sometimes presented.
What about the anxiety angle? Because I've personally dealt with this.
The sleep paradox. The more you care about sleep, the harder sleep becomes. And the research is clear. The anxiety from lying awake stressing about sleep does measurably more damage than the wakefulness itself. The stress hormones are worse than the lost sleep.
Which is why CBTI, cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, is the gold standard first-line treatment for chronic insomnia. Not sleeping pills. Therapy that targets the anxiety around sleep.
The biggest CBTI intervention is stimulus control. If you've been lying awake in bed for roughly 20 minutes or more, you get up. Leave the bedroom. Low light. Boring activity. Return to bed only when you genuinely feel sleepy.
Because your brain learns associations. Spend hours lying awake anxiously in bed, and the brain starts associating the bed with wakefulness and anxiety. That becomes a conditioned arousal response.
Lie down and cortisol rises because that's what your nervous system has been trained to do here. Stimulus control breaks that conditioning. Bed equals sleep. You have to rebuild that pairing deliberately.
CBTI outcomes beat sleeping pills in head-to-head trials for chronic insomnia, and the effects are durable where medication effects fade.
Sleep restriction therapy is another CBTI tool that sounds backwards. You temporarily restrict time in bed to only the hours you're actually sleeping, building adenosine pressure until you're reliably falling asleep fast. Then you gradually extend the window.
Counterintuitive. Evidence-backed. Works better than medication for chronic insomnia in trials.
And then orthosomnia, anxiety driven by obsessing over sleep tracker data. People who get an hour ring and start sleeping worse because they're checking scores every morning.
You feel fine. You check the app. Readiness score 52. Suddenly you're convinced you'll be impaired all day. The tracker becomes the stressor.
Track for trends over weeks, not nightly grades. Is your sleep timing consistent? Is HRV trending in a healthy direction? Those are signals. Single night scores are noise.
On supplements, melatonin. The physiological dose your pineal gland releases is 0.1 to 0.3 milligrams. Most capsules sold are 5 to 10 milligrams, 5 to 50 times the natural amount.
At high doses, you're desensitizing receptors and potentially building dependency. 0.3 to 0.5 milligrams is more effective for timing shifts than 5 milligrams. Most people are taking pharmacological doses thinking they're being natural.
Magnesium glycinate has real evidence, calming, supports GABA function, genuinely improves sleep quality. 400 milligrams an hour before bed. L-theanine at 200 milligrams reduces arousal without sedation. These are the supplements worth considering before anything pharmaceutical.
Okay. The topic I've been building toward, sleeping in a relationship. And I'll be personal here because abstract advice only goes so far.
I'll be direct about my starting position too. When Emma first raised some of this with me, my gut reaction was resistance. I had a traditional picture of what couples do.
Let's start with the numbers. 30 to 40% of couples report that their partner significantly disrupts their sleep. That's nearly half of all couples.
And most treat it as something to quietly manage, better earplugs, a gentle nudge, rather than addressing the structural causes.
The most fundamental structural cause is chronotype mismatch. 50% of couples have different chronotypes. Morning larks and night owls are not choosing to be difficult. It's genetic, the PR3 gene, the clock gene.
And chronotype shifts across your lifetime. Teenagers shift dramatically toward owls, later sleep, later wake. Not laziness. Biology. The adolescent circadian clock shifts by up to 2 hours compared to adults.
School start times at 7:30 a.m. are genuinely harmful for adolescent cognitive development, and this is a real public health issue that's rarely framed as a sleep science issue.
Then chronotype gradually shifts back. By your 50s and 60s, many people are waking at 5 without an alarm.
So what happens when a morning person tries to sleep with a night owl? The owl wants to be up until midnight. The lark is falling asleep at 10. The lark lies there for 2 hours waiting. Or the owl feels guilty and comes to bed early but can't sleep.
And nobody is wrong. Nobody is being inconsiderate. The biology just doesn't match.
But it gets framed as a character flaw, you stay up too late, you wake me up. Rather than as a biological reality with a practical solution.
The practical compromise, the lark goes to bed first, the owl comes later. You don't try to convert owls into larks, you can't sustainably. But the lark should maintain their consistent wake time. Consistency matters more than synchrony.
Then there's the movement issue. The average adult moves 40 to 60 times per night. Every time your partner moves, it causes a micro awakening in you. Even if you don't consciously register it, your brain cycles up toward waking and back down repeatedly all night.
The counterintuitive research finding, in objective studies, people sleep worse when sharing a bed. The micro-awakenings are measurable in brainwave data. But in self-report, people say they sleep better with their partner because of the emotional security.
So you're paying a real objective cost in sleep quality but getting a real subjective benefit in felt safety. Knowing that is useful, some of that psychological benefit can be achieved other ways, if separation is needed.
Motion-isolating mattresses make a genuine difference. Memory foam or hybrid mattresses with individually pocketed coils transfer far less movement than older innerspring designs.
And the Scandinavian sleep method. I genuinely didn't know this was a widespread cultural practice until a few years ago. In Scandinavia and much of Northern Europe, it's completely normal for a couple sharing a bed to have two separate duvets. Each person has their own.
No tug-of-war at 3 a.m. No cover stealing. Different temperatures, different weights.
All the physical closeness of sharing a bed, without the thermal conflict. And temperature conflict is real. Women and men often have different thermal preferences during sleep, and for women, hormonal variation across the menstrual cycle affects thermoregulation significantly.
Split-zone mattress toppers let each side be set independently. That one change can resolve an enormous amount of friction.
This sounds so obvious. Why do we share one duvet?
Cultural habit. Not biology. Not intimacy. Just an inherited assumption.
Snoring. 40% of adults snore. And your partner's snoring, even if it doesn't fully wake you, raises your cortisol. Your nervous system registers it as a potential threat, even while you're asleep. This is measurable in blood.
You're paying a physiological cost you're not consciously aware of.
Side sleeping rather than back sleeping reduces snoring significantly. Nasal strips help some people. Mouth tape, enforcing nasal breathing, sounds alarming but has evidence for mild cases.
For significant snoring with gasping or pausing, that's sleep apnea. And sleep apnea is 80% undiagnosed. Signs, snoring plus gasping, and waking exhausted regardless of hours slept.
Home sleep tests are now 100 to 200 euros. Wear a sensor overnight at home, get a full report. If you have apnea, CPAP is genuinely transformative for the person wearing it and for their partner.
Now, the sleep divorce. I'll be honest, when Emma first raised this, my gut reaction was, sleeping apart is giving up on something. The shared bed is part of intimacy. Part of what couples do.
I understand that instinct. But the research isn't ambiguous. Couples who sleep in separate rooms sleep better. Expected. What's less expected is that relationship satisfaction increases. Not decreases. Increases.
Because when you're not torturing each other's sleep, you're less irritable, more emotionally regulated, more patient. You're a better partner.
The shared bed isn't what creates intimacy. The relationship creates intimacy. The bed is just where you happen to be when you sleep.
Queen Victoria and Prince Albert slept in separate rooms. Many cultures don't co-sleep by default. The idea that the shared bed is the marker of intimacy is recent and culturally specific.
What shifted my thinking was a reframe. The question isn't, are we close enough to sleep together? The question is, what arrangement lets us both show up as our best selves during the day?
If separate rooms achieves that, it's not a failure. It's a deliberate, mature choice.
And it's a spectrum. Same room, same bed. Same room, separate beds. Separate rooms on specific bad nights. Illness, snoring phase, different chronotype nights. Separate rooms more regularly. Separate rooms permanently. You move along the spectrum based on what you need.
Something we've actually implemented, the bedtime ritual as a shared activity, regardless of where we end up sleeping. You wind down together, dim lights, no screens, some conversation. The transition to sleep doesn't have to be the point of departure.
It's more connecting than lying in the dark, irritably hoping the other one stops fidgeting.
New parents. The nuclear bomb for sleep.
Newborns have no circadian rhythm for the first 12 to 16 weeks. Their sleep is distributed across 24 hours. You cannot train that. You survive it strategically.
The anchor sleep strategy, one parent gets an unbroken 4-hour block, truly uninterrupted. The other handles all-night duties during that window. You swap every other night.
For unbroken hours preserves at least one full sleep cycle and protects some deep sleep architecture. Not ideal, but vastly better than both parents being fractured all night.
And it must be explicit. agree in advance, tonight is yours, tomorrow is mine. Otherwise both people lie there half listening and neither actually rests.
The ambiguity is worse than the work.
Okay. Let's do the practical protocol. What do you actually do?
Morning. Within 60 minutes of waking, outdoor light. No sunglasses for the first 10 to 15 minutes. Even overcast. Free 10 minutes, the highest leverage sleep habit that exists. Sets your circadian anchor.
Delay your first coffee 90 to 120 minutes after waking. Cortisol peaks naturally in the first hour of waking. It does much of what caffeine does. If you take caffeine on top of that natural peak, you blunt the body's own response and push your real energy peak later.
Wait for cortisol to do its job. Then layer caffeine. And last coffee before 1 or 2 p.m. Non-negotiable for deep sleep.
Exercise. Vigorous workouts should finish at least 4 hours before bed, ideally morning or early afternoon. Evening walks and light yoga are fine. Heavy lifting at 9 p.m. when you want to sleep at 10, not the move.
Wind down. 60 to 90 minutes before bed. Dim warm lights throughout the home, no screens. Start cooling the bedroom to 18 or 19 degrees. Blackout curtains. Light penetrates closed eyelids and suppresses melatonin, even without conscious awareness.
White noise or earplugs if urban noise or a snoring partner is a factor. And if you can't sleep, do not lie there stressing. Get up. Go somewhere else. Low light, boring activity. Return when genuinely sleepy. Protect the bed equals sleep association.
Supplements. Magnesium glycinate 400 mg, 1 hour before bed. L-theanine 200 mg. Melatonin only for travel and timing shifts, 0.5 mg, not 5. If you track, use it for trends over weeks. Watch consistency of timing, HRV direction, breathing rate as an early signal for illness or overtraining.
Synthesis. What actually moved the needle personally?
For me, the relationship piece. My partner is a morning person. I'm very much not. We spent years subtly frustrating each other's sleep without naming what was actually happening.
We'd frame it as inconsiderateness rather than as a chronotype mismatch with a structural solution.
When we finally named it as a chronotype problem, we stopped taking it personally. Separate duvets, me coming to bed later on nights that make sense, the anchor sleep conversation when one of us really needs a full night. It moved from friction to just a logistical thing we handle.
For me, the morning light was the missing piece. I was starting every day indoors, phone first, no outdoor exposure until mid-morning. Adding a 10-minute walk within the first hour changed my afternoon energy curve. Less reliant on a second coffee at 3 p.m. A real signal the clock is better calibrated.
And the anxiety piece. I think that's what most sleep content misses. All the optimization advice implicitly communicates that sleep is a performance you can fail. For anyone with anxiety, that framing actively makes things worse.
The real foundational shift is treating sleep as something your body wants to do, that you're removing obstacles to, rather than a target you're trying to hit.
You can't force sleep. You create conditions. And then you let go.
Which is deeply annoying advice, but also genuinely true.
As with most things worth knowing.
Thanks for being here on Claude Talks.
Sleep well.
Seriously. Sleep well.